From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The South did not move easily from Jim Crow to the 21st century. Social and political forces clashed publicly and violently in places like Birmingham and the Deep South throughout the Civil Rights era. But in his new book, Matthew Lassiter argues that it was suburban sprawl that transformed the political culture of the South, and this residential white flight had more profound effect on issues of racial integration than any premeditated political strategy. Matt Lassiter is an assistant professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics and the Sunbelt South. And Matt joins us now from Ann Arbor. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for inviting me. Great to be here.
And we're taking your phone calls this hour, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org if you want to send us an email. Matt, fascinating book. And, you know, when we think about the way Southern politics were shaped in the post-World War II period, we think of white supremacist resistance to the civil rights movement and then efforts by the Republican Party to exploit white resentment. But you say that that leaves out an important part of the story.
That's right. When I got into the project, I was trying to figure out how it was that the story that you see in Eyes on the Prize and the typical story is about Birmingham and Mississippi and racial extremists, and then you end up with a Republican Party dominant in the South, Newt Gingrich and the rest, that represent suburban districts like Cobb County outside Atlanta, where there are tons of people living there who weren't even born in the South, and trying to make that connection. And I decided you had to look at the suburbs, not just at the Deep South, not just at the rural areas, and not just at the working class, but what middle class, upper middle class white professionals who lived in, white collar professionals too, who lived in residentially segregated metropolitan regions, look at their political behavior and their role in the civil rights movement.
Well, but couldn't you explain that simply by going back to its origins, this, again, a kind of white supremacist effort to hang on to a segregated South, and that simply had its effect over the generations and ended up with segregated suburbs as well?
There are a couple points to make. First of all, the Southern political structure coming out of World War II was still a one-party system, and power was concentrated in the rural parts of the South, in the Black Belt region, where there were a lot of African Americans, the agricultural economy, and a lot of this had to do with political malapportionment. You didn't have the one person, one vote ruling from the Supreme Court until the mid-1960s. And at the same time, in the presidential elections, 1952, 1956, Dwight Eisenhower performed very well among white middle-class voters. He won a number of southern states, upper south states, the places that we would now call part of the Sun Belt. And so I think that suburban areas of the South were already trending Republican before the Brown decision, or especially before Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. And if we tell the story of how the South turned Republican just by looking at working class white backlash and looking at George Wallace voters moving to Richard Nixon voters, it misses the way that suburban and metropolitan regions were moving in North Carolina, outside Atlanta, similar to Orange County in Los Angeles or Phoenix and other parts of the country, suburbs outside of Chicago even, that I think this is a national trend toward the Republican Party becoming the party of suburban privilege, not just the Southern story.
So explain what's going on now. And again, you make a distinction between the Black Belt South and the Sun Belt South, those states that had larger urban areas that could then develop suburbs.
Well, these are divisions within states, not just within the region. And in my book, I tried to look at places like Atlanta, Charlotte, Richmond, Virginia, and I see these metropolitan centers as really not all that different from Los Angeles, from Denver, from Philadelphia even, in the sense that there's a growing city-suburban divide in the way that local politics plays out, and the federal government is massively subsidizing patterns of residential segregation in the suburbs. At the same time, all sorts of policies at the state, local, and federal level are building the inner city ghettos that would come to be called the urban crisis by the mid-1960s, and that these trends are really national trends. They're happening in southern cities, and it took, among other things, it took the civil rights movement to break apart the dominance of the one-party South, in the sense that the Supreme Court finally comes down and says, you can't malapportion districts. People who live outside Atlanta have to have the same amount of political power. the same amount of representation in state government as you do if you live in a rural area. But there's a broader story here, and it's about the economic development of the region into what we call the Sun Belt today.
Well, I'd like you to define that region, both regions within the state and the regions, those states that qualify as Sun Belt states, and then talk a little bit about what you call state finance suburbanization, just how it is that these federal subsidies helped promote suburban sprawl.
Okay, the Sun Belt pretty much means from Virginia to Southern California, and it's become a shorthand way to describe the parts of the country that really boomed after World War II, especially as a result of Cold War spending policies, a lot of military bases, defense industries. So if you look at Southern California, the Defense Department and Cold War-based companies are really building that up. And the same thing happened outside of Atlanta or in the Virginia Beach area of the state of Virginia. And also a lot of white-collar professional growth. Northern businesses are relocating factories to the south, to the west, to the Sun Belt. And they're also building new branch offices. And so this is the idea of a corporate white-collar economy that's emerging.
And this is happening all over the country. And this is the point that you make, that we don't have this exceptional South anymore. The South is no longer an exception to American growth and American political movements after World War II. It is very deeply integrated into the movement that's taking place all across the country.
That's right. And in fact, since the 1960s, from these policies, and there's a kind of irony in the politics, the conservative politics that are produced in the South and the Southwest during this time, because it's the federal government more than anything else that provides the military bases, that helps build the interstate highway system, that makes it possible to live in sprawling suburbs outside of these major cities. And at the same time, the political culture that emerges from the corporate South, but also from the suburban South, is about anti-government. The federal government didn't do anything for me. The federal government doesn't have a right to come in, for example, and tell me that my children have to be bused outside of their neighborhood into an inner city because I got to where I was all by myself,
right?
That it had nothing to do with public policies.
So you have the paradox of the American dream and the meritocracy of life in the suburbs juxtaposed against subsidies for home mortgages, subsidies for highways that allow suburban sprawl, subsidies for other homeownership subsidies that allow all this to happen for a middle class that had the advantage coming out of World War II. And if you didn't have those advantages, then the GI Bill, then you couldn't take advantage of the subsidies and move to the suburbs.
That's exactly right. In my book, I call this the ideology of colorblind meritocracy. And the idea is that individual accomplishment explains why some people live in suburbs and why some people live in inner city neighborhoods of poverty. But to take one example, I looked at the census tracts where the anti-busing movement in Charlotte emerged, the white suburban middle-class anti-busing movement. And in the main census tracts, there were about 85,000 whites living there and about 130 African Americans. And so this is a new form. It's not Jim Crow in the sense that this is not based on law, specifically formal law, but public policies to a degree that I think most Americans still don't recognize. Public policies help shape who lived where in the post-war South and in the post-war nation. And you mentioned a couple federal mortgage policies said that you could not invest or give people loans in neighborhoods that were integrated. And so it helped push toward segregation. And at the same time, the Interstate Highway Program and urban renewal smashed through black neighborhoods mainly, relocated a lot of African Americans into public housing units. And at the same time, these are the highways that white suburbanites are using to get to their jobs downtown. Suburbs use exclusionary zoning policies to keep out all sorts of people based on both race and class to maintain a more homogeneous neighborhood. And there's really historians have reached a consensus on this, that there's a constellation of public policies that are the critical element in explaining residential segregation in the United States.
Well, that's how we get residential segregation. Then talk to us about how that adds to the resistance to school desegregation.
Well, so the Brown decision, the way it plays out in the South, initially in cities like Atlanta, Charlotte, Raleigh, and others, is that school boards accept the transfer of a couple black students into white schools. And eight or nine, and then Southern school boards move toward what they call freedom of choice plans, where African-American students can apply to transfer to white schools. And by the mid-1960s, the NAACP is going back to the courts and saying, this isn't enough. This is integrating a few black students, mainly middle-class black students, into mostly white schools, but it's not doing anything about the concentrated segregation in the areas where blacks live in these big cities. And so we're going to have some sort of busing plan, because if housing segregation is the core of the problem, not just Jim Crow laws, then the only way to deal with housing segregation, unless we're going to integrate neighborhoods, is to have busing across neighborhood lines. And the NAACP, I should add, said this in northern cities as well. Busing in Boston, busing in Detroit, busing out west in Los Angeles and San Francisco. This was a nationwide strategy by the NAACP.
And this runs afoul with the notion of the American dream. It's my property. I moved out here precisely for these schools that I want my kids to go to. And we'll talk more about how the lawsuits emerged out of those trends with my guest, Matt Lassiter, the author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sun Belt South. Take your phone calls at 877-962-9862 or emails at sot@wunc.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcast from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The Nixon administration gets a lot of credit for breaking up the solid Democratic South by exploiting Southern resentment against court-ordered integration. But with a new perspective on regional history and the power of suburbanization and post-World War II consumerism, Matt Lassiter takes a different view of the Unified South. Matt Lassiter is with us today to talk about those ideas from his new book, The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sun Belt South. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. And you talked in your book, Matt, about the location of homes and schools, which had become the marker of a family's socioeconomic status. And you were just telling us about the story in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and how those schools became the effort to fight desegregation there.
That's right. The NAACP filed a lawsuit in 1968, or I should say they refiled a lawsuit that had been ongoing, and said Charlotte is segregated based on housing patterns. And previously, this has been considered de facto segregation, meaning the government had nothing to do with it. De facto segregation was understood at the time as Northern-style segregation based on neighborhood patterns and private racial attitudes. And the NAACP said in Charlotte, it was really their test case. They were going to prove that government policies caused segregation of neighborhoods, and therefore government was responsible for a remedy. And the remedy was two-way busing, not just busing black students into white suburban areas, but busing white students into black areas. And it should be noted also that Charlotte was a test case in part because the city and is consolidated into the county school system. Mecklenburg County has a very large countywide school system, and so it was an opportunity to try to come up with integration that wouldn't cause white flight, because you couldn't move to the suburbs of Mecklenburg County and escape the busing plan.
Well, and you point out in your book how that is different here in North Carolina, where cities like Raleigh and Charlotte have taken in the suburbs. In a sense, they've annexed what would have been the suburbs, unlike places like Detroit and Boston, where suburban school districts fight to keep control not only of their students, but the purse as well.
This is such an important part of the story, and I think a benefit that a lot of people living in North Carolina, especially new migrants, don't quite understand how important this is. Part of the reason that I compared Atlanta to Charlotte in my book is that I grew up outside Atlanta. I actually grew up in the suburb of Sandy Springs, which was the first suburb to reject annexation into Atlanta in 1966. And where I grew up, most whites went to private school or very segregated public schools, very affluent part of Atlanta, an inner ring suburb it would be considered now. And in Charlotte, in a place like Myers Park, which is very similar in a lot of ways, you couldn't escape being part of the city school system and part of the integration plan. And I was curious about this. And North Carolina law allows the automatic annexation of suburbs. If you ask any business leader in North Carolina, they'll tell you that this is crucial to North Carolina's ability to have healthier cities, to keep the suburban and the urban tax base in under the same municipal government. And it also is the reason, I think, more than anything else, that North Carolina's cities, that its metropolitan areas, achieved a greater degree of racial integration after in the Brown era than probably anywhere else in the country, possibly with the exception of Florida, because every school district in Florida is a countywide school district. And so the NAACP didn't have to grapple with how do you integrate cities that are becoming majority black, because most of the cities in North Carolina remain majority white because of annexation in the school districts, because they're countywide.
That said, you talk in the book about the resegregation that's occurred in Charlotte-Mecklenburg and call it a more virulent form. Why is that, and how has that happened, given the fact that that there is a larger tax base?
Well, Charlotte faces a lawsuit in the late 1990s by seven parents who object to the race-conscious assignment policies. And it's important to note that this is not the original two-way busing plan. Charlotte in the late 80s puts into place more of a magnet school system where whites, blacks, Latinos, everybody applies to be in particular schools, but the magnet schools take race into account to try to achieve an integrated student body. And in Charlotte, a group of white parents, most of whom were corporate transplants, filed a lawsuit saying that this violates the colorblind requirements of the Constitution. And this is the same argument that the anti-busing movement made in Charlotte in the late 1960s and early 1970s, that it's unconstitutional to take race into account, in effect that it is reverse discrimination. But the difference is that there's a different judge and a different legal climate than there was in the 1970s. And in fact, the judge who ordered Charlotte to discontinue using race in its assignment policies had been an original member of the anti-busing movement back in the late 1960s.
This is Judge Potter, right?
This is Judge Potter. Now he's sitting on the federal bench, appointed by Ronald Reagan, and he says that Charlotte's race-conscious assignment policies to maintain diversity is, quote, standing in the schoolhouse door. In other words, using the image of George Wallace to say that an effort to maintain integration is morally the same, I believe that's what the judge is trying to say, as an effort to segregate schools under Jim Crow. And this, of course, is part of the larger, more a conservative claim that society should be colorblind, even if it brings about resegregation.
And the NAACP argument against that all the way along, because that argument was raised right at the very beginning throughout the effort to desegregate, that was the argument that our, you know, we need to have a colorblind society. And the argument against that is that you have to do something to reverse the damage that's already been done, the advantages that have already accumulated on the one side and disadvantages that have accumulated on the other.
Right. The argument is that you have to take race into account in order to undo the long legacies of racial discrimination, that there hasn't been some magical moment, whether in Charlotte or in Raleigh or anywhere in the country, where the effects of all the different ways, not just Jim Crow, but the whole infrastructure of how metropolitan areas developed after World War II, there's no magic moment when everything just became colorblind or just became de facto segregation. And Martin Luther King is often cited by advocates of what I call colorblind conservatism, and his speech at the March on Washington, the one line where he said, "You shouldn't be judged by the color of your skin, but by the content of your character." And this ignores a lot of the other things that Martin Luther King said. He repeatedly wrote in the mid-1960s that special compensatory programs would be necessary to undo the legacies of racial discrimination. And so I don't think Martin Luther King Jr. would be excited to be put into an alliance with, you know, forces that are aiming for the resegregation of these school districts in the South that actually achieved a fair amount of integration under the Brown decision mandate.
Well, and the lawsuit in Charlotte-Mecklenburg did effectively amount to the end of busing, but you say that it really resulted in a more virulent form of resegregation. Why is that? How could that be?
That's right. Charlotte looks a lot different than it did in the late 1960s. Among other things, in Charlotte, as in Atlanta, as all over the country, the black middle class suburbanization is a major part of the story of the last 30 years. And middle class, upper middle class African Americans don't tend to live in the same neighborhoods as working class or poor African Americans. And as Charlotte's resegregating, about half of the schools in Charlotte-Mecklenburg are now mostly minority. And this is not just biracial as it was 30 years ago. This is now a lot of Latinos as well as African Americans. These schools are not just concentrations of racial segregation. They're concentrations of economic segregation as well. And all of the educational, the sociological literature shows that if you put not only minority students, but a large majority of impoverished students in the same schools, those schools will be on the list of the worst schools. And this is a recipe for disaster.
And it's important to point out that the suggestion here is that under Jim Crow and de jure segregation, you have at least in these cities a thriving or a black middle class, so that there is some kind of class diversity under Jim Crow that we lose once African Americans, middle class, get to move out and move into other neighborhoods. And so you're left with the poorest of the poor.
Right. I don't think we should romanticize the Jim Crow period, and it was a terrible and tragic era of discrimination, but there is something different about today, in that the ghetto, or what we would call the ghetto, the inner city neighborhoods of high poverty, are not the places where middle class minorities tend to live. There are still a lot of disadvantages facing middle class black suburbs, but in other places that I looked, like Richmond and Atlanta, most of the whites left the school district by the 1970s, and most middle-class blacks had left by the 1990s. That they followed whites out, and the people who are left behind in these underfinanced, you know, school districts, in these really hyper-segregated school districts by both race and income, tend to be poor and a lot of disadvantages anyway before getting to school.
So let's take a look now at the national political picture. Again, the conventional wisdom is that however it came about, there is now a growing resentment and a political movement against integration in the South, and the Republican Party sees its opportunity. Richard Nixon coins the term the silent majority, and he goes in he and Spiro Agnew make speeches in the South trying to rally and essentially capitalize on this resentment. And you say that we're giving too much credibility to that particular aspect, and again have left out part of the story.
The 1968 election is really interesting because you have a three-way election. George Wallace is running as an independent candidate. He's the segregationist governor of Alabama, and the Democrats have nominated Hubert Humphrey. And Nixon, I argue that he goes for the moderate vote, in the sense that he goes for the suburban vote. And in white-collar suburbs outside of Charlotte, outside of Atlanta, Nixon wins 65 to 70% of the votes in a three-way election, which is pretty extraordinary. George Wallace does better among working-class whites and among rural whites in the South. Hubert Humphrey wins mainly the white liberals and, you know, the African-American vote overwhelmingly. And Nixon went around to southern metro regions like Charlotte, and he gave the same speech there that he gave outside the South. I talk in my book about what he said in Charlotte when he went down there in the fall of 1968, and he said, "My campaign is for the forgotten Americans, the people who pay their taxes, who work hard, who go to church, white people and black people, people who don't riot." And I argue two things: that it's really important that Nixon always said white people and black people, because this is a kind of colorblind language that's meant to appeal to white moderates who don't like liberalism but think George Wallace is a rabble-rouser, kind of a working-class demagogue, and their class status would be jeopardized by voting for George Wallace. And at the same time, in Charlotte, Nixon is asked about integration and busing, and he says, "I support the Brown decision and I support integration, but we shouldn't send poor students into affluent districts. Not because that would be about race, but because this is socioeconomic integration. And we all know that socioeconomic integration won't work." At least that's what Nixon said.
And he says, "You have no reason to feel guilty about wanting to enjoy what you get and getting what you earn." So again, promoting this idea of meritocracy.
Right. The Kerner Commission in 1968, a famous report which was commissioned by President Lyndon Johnson after the Detroit and the Newark riots of 1967. And the Kerner Commission came out with a famous controversial statement, which said, "What white Americans have never understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto, that white institutions create it and condone it and maintain it." And in my view, Nixon is responding directly to this claim that the civil rights movement is making, that the Kerner Commission is making, that residential segregation, that whites are guilty for this, both suburban segregation and inner city containment. And he's saying that white Americans are innocent. And he says the same thing in Los Angeles and Detroit that he says in Charlotte and Atlanta, that this is really for the, that he's aiming at the white, hardworking, you know, white and black, hardworking people that he would later call the silent majority, a label he comes up with in 1970, and that many of the grassroots political movements that I talk about in my book embrace this idea that they are part of the silent majority.
And that this ignores all of the advantages in lending policies, in subsidies for mortgages and all, and education policies for those who have already had this advantage, that they're able to actually take advantage of these things and move on. So it ignores the kind of stack deck policy or ideology that underlies the colorblind philosophy.
That's right. I think one of the limitations of the civil rights movement was that coming out of World War II, the mainstream opinion about white supremacy and white racism was that this was a problem in people's hearts and minds. And if you could convince white Americans not to be racist, then that would be the real accomplishment. And by the mid to late 1960s, the civil rights movement is coming to realize that there are real structural inequalities in place, that even if a particular white family is not racist at all, if you live in a completely segregated neighborhood and send your children to a completely segregated neighborhood school, this is a subset of a larger racist, you know, metropolitan landscape, a consequence of a set of public policies. And eradicating individual racism is not enough. And many of the people who joined the anti-busing movements that I write about in my book say over and over, "We're not racist. We just made a huge investment in our home. We want our children to go to school close to their home." And I think they're sincere in that. I don't question those attitudes at all. But the larger question is, what responsibility do they have as people who were really advantaged by the same public policies that disadvantaged racial minorities during the post-war decades?
Which explains why Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement are wildly successful in the deeply segregated white supremacist South and have enormous success there, and quick success in some ways. And then the movement falls apart in Cicero, Illinois, over a question of housing.
Well, that's exactly right. And eventually it turned out that if you provoked white violence in Alabama and in Mississippi, you get the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, which is a national majority and reforms aimed at the South. But when King goes to Chicago in 1966, there is massive white violence against his marches and the local Chicago civil rights movement's marches into all-white suburbs. And the goal is to get the federal government to pass an Open Housing Act. And nothing happens. And then by 1968, right before he's assassinated, King is planning a poor people's campaign. And there's almost, you know, this is basically outside of the liberal mainstream, not just conservative backlash, by 1968. And I'll tell you one quick story because I think it's really relevant. I'm working on a book right now called The Suburban Crisis about the whole country. And Martin Luther King, a couple months before the March on Washington, went to Detroit and gave a speech that became the basis of the March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech, in Detroit before he ever went to Washington, D.C. And he said at the time, we have to look at housing segregation, we have to look at employment discrimination, and racism in the North is just as much of a problem as racism in the South. And the civil rights movement is not going to be successful if all we do is end voting discrimination and Jim Crow laws in the South, that we have to really have a national scope here. And in the end, this is about housing as much as anything else.
And you talked just a minute ago, too, about the grassroots organizations that were already in place. And to a large extent, your research and book upends the theory that there was a kind of top-down strategy, a southern strategy that the Republicans imposed or structured, that in fact these grassroots movements were already in place and were largely responsible for the change.
I argue, yes, you're right. I argue that rather than seeing the political change in the South, especially in places like North Carolina, Florida, Virginia, Tennessee, rather than seeing this as a result of a Southern strategy, we should look at Nixon's appeals as part of what I call a suburban strategy, that he's making the same kind of appeals in the suburban South as he is in the rest of the country. And by 1972, Nixon himself says, "I don't have a Southern strategy or a Northern strategy. I have a one-nation strategy." And he won 49 states in the 1972 election. Back in 1968, he won the Upper South, but he did not win the states that Barry Goldwater and George Wallace carried. And I think we need to look at Nixon's accomplishments, and we can talk more about grassroots politics if you want.
And we'll talk a little bit, too, about suburban strategies and how they will play out now and in the future with Matt Lassiter, assistant professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sunbelt South. Just ahead, more of your phone calls and emails and more conversation with Matt Lassiter. Our number is 877-962-9862. On the State of Things, stay with us. It's the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking this hour about the power of suburban politics in resisting integration, unifying the South and the nation during the 60s and 70s. And we're joined by Matt Lassiter, assistant professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics of the Sunbelt South, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. We're talking about the sort of suburban grassroots politics responsible for change in Southern politics in the 70s. And let's move us forward a little bit and talk about where we are today and where this is leading. You say in your book, look, in the end, corporate leaders and their political allies always chose growth over equality, suburban sprawl over social justice. Should this have been our focus all along?
This is a comment I make at the end of the book to try to explain what's happening, especially as Charlotte resegregates. And I think looking at both Charlotte and Raleigh here is instructive, because Raleigh actually consolidated its city school system with the county school system in the mid-1970s, and it was engineered by business leaders. And they looked at Atlanta and Richmond, which were becoming black majority districts with massive white flight, and they looked at Charlotte, which was, through comprehensive busing, was becoming a very integrated district despite all sorts of political backlash against that. And Raleigh's business leaders thought, we would rather have comprehensive busing than a mostly or all black city school system surrounded by hostile white suburbs. And so they said at the time, the goal is to make Raleigh an attractive climate for business. And I think that in Charlotte and in Raleigh both, the business leaders, Chamber of Commerce leaders, have said this publicly, that this was crucial to their efforts to become new South cities, to recruit Northern companies down, to put themselves on the map as different from Birmingham, as different from places, even different from, say, Detroit, which is a city that has terrible racial animosities. And so business leaders would tell you that that integration has been good for business. But when you started to get opposition again in the 1990s, hundreds of thousands of whites moving in to these areas, often from outside the South, from the Northeast, from the Midwest, and saying, why should our children have to be bused outside of their neighborhood? What's going on here? The business leaders compromised, I think, and in Charlotte, they helped put in the magnet school plan. And in Raleigh, this is part of the move toward a class-based or socioeconomic-based integration plan, which is a really innovative effort, and it's under siege right now.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from John, who is in Raleigh. Hello, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I guess 2 points. Now that you've actually brought up Wake County, we lived in Mecklenburg County and actually in the city limits of Charlotte when the court case was going down in the late 90s and early 2000s, and all of the, I guess you'd say, the animosities were being risen again in some sort of way. And, you know, my biggest thing about living in Charlotte was, you know, we had children, not necessarily mine, but other children of friends of ours, who were being picked up by buses at 5:30 in the morning and weren't getting home until, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon because they were being bused. And what you have to look at is, I understand that it's very important that, you know, I don't want my own children going to an all-white school or an all-black school because I want them learning the different ethnicities that everybody brings to the table. But when your children are leaving the house at 5:30 and not getting home until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, you have to understand that there is a quality of life issue which is just as important to children at that age. And now we actually live in Wake County, and we're starting to see just a massive explosion of growth. You know, we're having very bad problems right now finding space in schools for every child. And there are situations like you're saying now, you know, you take Wake Forest, for instance, in that area, and a lot of these people built these million-dollar homes up in the Wake Forest area, and now they were talking about having to bus their children to a predominantly black school because what they're concerned with is the white ritzy school versus the black kind of poor school. Again, I think the whole busing issue goes back in a way, and what we have to understand, we need to balance this issue of racial profile in schools with the understanding of the quality of life for that child.
Right, John, well, let me get a response from Matt Lassiter, and I appreciate your call, John. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate the call, too, and I'll make a couple of points. First of all, this is the same argument that's made in the late 60s, early 70s, that this is maybe diversity is a good thing, but you have to think about quality of life. And an important point to make is that busing addressed the symptom, but the problem was housing segregation. And there have been a few places in the United States, Montgomery County, Maryland, for example, is a leader, that have made a real effort to say that every new development has to have a certain percentage of low-income housing. That if housing segregation is the core, then maybe we should address housing segregation, not just school integration. And I would, although I think Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and Raleigh, Wake County, the Wake County public school system, achieve a larger degree of racial integration than almost any other places in the country, I think that these districts, the business leaders who basically ran these cities, can be criticized because even after school integration really, really took off in the mid-1970s, almost all new suburban developments are still maintaining or exacerbating residential segregation. And so if we're going to build these new ritzy suburbs way, way far out, and we know in advance that this will create neighborhood schools that are segregated like the housing developments, then we have a choice as a society, which is if we don't want children to attend almost all white or all affluent schools, then we shouldn't build these kind of neighborhoods without including some affordable housing. So I really think that would be a way to move beyond this debate a little bit and say maybe housing shouldn't be as segregated.
But is it the way, or would we be addressing yet another symptom and not looking comprehensively enough at all of the factors that go into this? Lending practices, the way money flows to the highest return. Is that ever going to give you a more balanced society when people have already begun with a disadvantage? Do you have to look at a more comprehensive approach?
I think so. I mean, it's a tough issue, but if you have countywide zoning, then you can zone exclusionary or you can zone inclusionary. And if Mecklenburg County or Wake County lets a developer build 1,500 homes and they're all sell for $450,000 or more, that's a deliberate public policy decision to create an economically segregated neighborhood, which will then get its schools and everything else. And zoning authority can work both ways. You can make a deliberate public policy decision through zoning authority to say, any new development, if you want us to build the roads, give you the sewer system, you know, hook you up with an interstate exit, all of the many ways that growth on the fringe is subsidized by development policies, if you want us to do that, then you have to put 18%, 15% affordable housing in your new development. people who are low income need to be able to get the jobs in the service economy, in the malls that are out on the fringe, that this is a better way to organize society. If we say we like diversity, then diversity should happen not just in the schoolroom, but in the places where people live as well.
Matt, let's go back to the beginning of this conversation. If we accept that we have been looking at history all wrong, and particularly the regional history of the South, or at least not including enough of the story, I wonder if, and we may have lost some time in terms of coming up with solutions. You've recently worked with Jimmy Carter, I know, to bring about a discussion in Atlanta about whether we've been thinking about regional history in all the wrong ways. Are there better ways to look at the history of the South, particularly in the last half century?
Well, I organized a conference in Atlanta a couple weeks ago with Joe Crispino, who's a assistant professor at Emory, working on a book about Mississippi. And we got Jimmy Carter to give the keynote address. And the conference was called The End of Southern History? Integrating the Modern South and the Nation. And one of the big questions that we asked in the conference is that if we see political change in the South as a result of this Southern strategy, which is about saying that the South is exceptional, or even this whole red-blue dichotomy idea, then this is about creating a South that's set apart from the nation, and it makes it hard to tell national history accurately. And the same thing for the civil rights movement. And I actually began my talk by mentioning the Martin Luther King speech in Detroit in 1963, and said, why have almost no Americans ever heard of Martin Luther King in 63 saying housing segregation is the heart of this? And it's a sobering conclusion, I guess, but the suggestion I would make is that the liberal agenda for civil rights reform that triumphed in 1964, 1965 only held together as long as the target of reform was the most excessive parts of the South, Mississippi and Alabama and these areas. And once it became issues of housing, issues that are so wrapped up in ideas of individual meritocracy and this is just the American dream, the civil rights movement really ran up against the limits of reform in this country. And the places where after 1965 the civil rights movement really made substantial gains were places like in Charlotte, where they convinced a federal judge to order comprehensive integration against the opposition of large numbers of people.
All right, Matt Lassiter, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Lassiter is the author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sunbelt South, an assistant professor of history at the University of Michigan. Up next, a peek behind the curtain, or in this case, the mobile booth for StoryCorps. Stay with us.